Yeah.
The first one. And the Tosfot claims we don't do that. We don't do it in the North Europe. We can't wait to Tzedek HaKochavim. And he reads it, you know, completely different. The first one, you don't have to go far away.
What's
the news?
I want to go.
Yeah.
I want to ask the opposite. But
I thought somebody asked it. Yes.
No, I'm saying we're discussing it a lot about kulot in a certain way, about rereading, even though you're exempt from Rabbi Rabinovich, which goes the other way. But in a certain sense, you read some tshuvas of the Noda Yehuda, and you read some psukim of Chazon Ish. They, in a certain sense, were totally originalists in the sense that they upended, hundreds, if not thousands, of years of Minhag Ashkenaz to reread the way they understood sources and, just the issue of shiurim, right? A total transformation of what was done as halacha, not just mimetic, but also in the books. They totally upended everything, so...
So I think, again, the problem is always going to be, but then people come to you and they say, and I had this argument with friends and foes all the time, right? Well, since so-and-so misunderstood the Gemara, right? Why can't I, right? And so-and-so read the Gemara in accordance with their needs. So are there any boundaries to what I can do?
Okay, that's a good question.
That's a good question.
Right, so I'm trying to figure out where the... So I guess what I was reading 10 minutes, what I want to do is put out one possibility about boundaries. So the Gemara in Bava Metzia that I wanted to teach, which is a very famous Gemara, where Rabbi Bar Bar Chanan has certain manual laborers who are schleppers, right, break his wine, and they don't have the money to pay for the wine, so he takes their clothing, and then they come and tell Rav, and Rav says, give them their clothes, and he says to him, is that the law? And he answers, yes and no. Yes, and he quotes a pasuk from Mishlei. And then, right, they, emboldened by obviously having a friendly judge, say, okay, so we don't have to, right, so he has to give back our clothing because of the poor is l'man telech b'derech tovim. We worked all day, don't we get our salaries? And Rav says, yes, you get your salaries because v'orachot tzadikim tishmor. So, right, so these people work, we don't know how long they work, let's say they worked for an hour, they were supposed to schlep this wine barrel for 200 yards, they schlepped it 100 yards, and then they dropped it, smash. So Rav is out, for all we know, is a $1,000 bottle of wine. And these schleppers who are going to make $10 an hour are demanding, not only does he have to, right, he doesn't get to keep their clothing as security for the $1,000 worth of wine, even adding insult, right, literally, right, adding insult to injury, he has to pay them $10. So what does this mean? So people often want this to mean that we side with the poor and the laborers against the rich and the capitalists. Right? That's pretty straightforward, right? And that's very attractive. But it's, next people point out, but that's against the pasuk in the Torah.
Right?
The pasuk in the Torah says you're not allowed to favor the poor. So what's possible pshat in this story? So I thought pshat in the story is, I should say that my teacher, Rabbi J. David Bleich, disagrees with me forcefully about this. I think pshat in this story, which I learned from when my mother, Aleha Shalom, was being a lawyer for reinsurance companies, is that you have this phenomenon in law called set-offs. Right? Set-offs are, if I owe you $100, you owe me $100, nobody owes anything. Where set-offs break down is in bankruptcy cases. Right, because I owe you $100 and you're bankrupt. You owe me $100, but you owe 1,000 other people $100 each. So why should I get the $100 as opposed to your $100? Right, so that's why my mother's law firm made lots and lots of money, Friend?
The law firm got the $100.
The law firm, yeah. In the end, and this is worse than that, because the two insurance companies that are suing each other are both owned by the same mutual funds, with the same stockholders, right? So the lawyers from both sides get the money, right, from the same people who are suing each other. It's the most ridiculous thing imaginable. But all this was created, right, the Balshada story, the reason this whole system was created was so I could understand pshat in this Sugim Bava Metzia, which I would never have had my mother not become this sort of lawyer. Later she became a mediator. But so the pshat is that, I think, that Nobody could possibly claim that the laborers, if they were in fact culpable, don't owe Rav $1,000. They broke his wine barrel, they negligibly owe him $1,000. And the question is, under what circumstances, all right, do they have to pay the $1,000 immediately? And he also owes them the $10 for their work, because they worked. So what you have is a $1,000 debt on the one hand and a $10 debt on the other hand. And set-offs are an issue of judicial discretion. Right, whether to set off a debt or not is not necessarily something that has to be fixed in law. That's a matter of judicial discretion. So Rav used his judicial discretion to say, you know what, you'll pay the $1,000 over the next 100 years, $10 a year, and meanwhile he'll pay you his $10 now. Right, that, I think, is the solution. The challenge is, so that's judicial discretion, but here's the challenge of this whole area of law. So in my mind, the purpose of law and the purpose of the Torah in doing this, so this is my projecting my perhaps conservative political positions onto halacha, but I think emes kefish ani ro'eh, that if it became clear that judges favored the poor, then one of two things would happen. Either the rich would ignore the law, or the rich would buy other judges. Right? Because the rich have more power than the poor. And what you have is, but because the rich have an interest in order, So the rich agree to set up an impartial system which follows rules, which perhaps they have more, right, in many systems they have more say in making than the poor, but that's part of why we have a revelational system, so that the rich have less influence, and then we have a meritocratic intellectual system, hopefully, so the rich have less influence that way. But fundamentally, we acknowledge that there will always be some kind of bias towards the rich in the making of law, but it's worth it for the poor, because otherwise the rich would be unbounded. So I think that this is an example where there's a strong temptation to turn one's ethical impulse into law. But it's one that has to really be resisted, because the legislation of one's ethical impulse, in fact, undermines the whole existence of law. Right, people? That's why the Torah says it. Because law is the interest of the poor. A second example of that we won't have time to go into, I just put a brief version of a much longer article I wrote, which of the question of whether there should be halachot for foreign military intervention to prevent genocide. Now, this is an issue which probably all of you have very strong ethical implications. So should that be halacha? Right? So I argued that we should create a halacha that obligates military intervention to prevent genocide, and then I tried to bound it legally as to what constitutes genocide, which is an issue that has been engaged in international law at all. But I think that a fair critique of what I'm doing often, that people usually raise when I do it, is that shouldn't be law. Right? It might be the right thing to do, but it shouldn't be law.
I think that the main proof to what you are saying is mm-hmm. the fact that issues of bin Adam Chavor, there's no halachot. Before the Chafetz Chaim, there were nothing about Lashon Hara, 2.5 halachot in the Rambam. All the Lashon Hara, in the sages wrote tremendous amount on Lashon Hara, but in the Musar books, in the Amidot books, about the Mitzvah Sheker, there's no halachot, no book, until today. No book about Halbanat Kli Chavoro Barabim, nothing. I mean, it's not only that, it's also no legal punishment, because it's a lav she'e bo maaseh, so therefore, and be shor dvarim patur, so it's not, it's a completely different way of thinking, of confronting those issues, so that's a big proof to what you're saying.
Okay, good, so that was a tie-in, 2-minute summary at the end. So here's what Shirley says is absolutely correct, and we should all read Professor Sayman's book when it comes out about whether halacha is law, and in what areas is halacha law? Is it law in Choshen Mishpat? Is it law in Medan Al-Khaviro? Is it law in Ishud? Is it law? Here's what I want to suggest is that in many of the areas where we are, many in the construction of Orthodox responses to modernity. So one of the things we have to remember is that in the same way that the poor have a fundamental interest in the existence of law, and actually had a secondary interest in the content of that law. So for Orthodox religious experience, there is a fundamental interest in the experience of halakha as law in some way, with all the provisos that halakha is not law in all areas in the same way. And about whether we want to turn ethics into law, there is a fundamental interest in the experience of halakha as law. And one of the questions we have to keep asking ourselves is, when we make halakha more malleable and more amenable to people's immediate content interests, what we often end up doing is undermining their experience of halakha as law. The metaphor for this are all the solutions that would be matir women who are otherwise agunot that the women won't take, because the consequence of accepting that heter is undermining the whole system by which you lived your life, right? It made your kedushin meaningless. Right? This is a very hard thing, right? So that's the issue. What I want to set out is that all the issues that I set out for muddling through, but a metric for muddling through, is the extent to which it preserves the genuine experience of the people who are living the law, not just those who are deciding it, as living under a law, and not living under a subjective code of values. And now we'll talk about it in the public context. I don't have a clear metric. I mean, I'm suggesting certain kinds of avenues for exploration. But that's what I want to get out of it, is that's really, you have to think about to what extent can a legal system survive if people push the step this further, or at that point people just say, no, you know what? At this point you're just making it up. And I could make up the same thing. Right? So one of my students, for example, constantly argues that really people can always follow what they think is a plausible interpretation of the text. And I always argue, no, right? The fact that it's a plausible interpretation of a text is not enough. It has to have authority. Now, who has authority? What constitutes authority? Right? How do we deal with what seem to be illegitimate exclusions of authority, perhaps of women? Right? Those are all hard questions. But I think that the notion of authority is an essential component of law, and how we figure that out is a major challenge. Yes, Reverend, you had Charlie. Yes.
On the issue of the war thing. It's not surprising that there's not developed halakha, even though there are pesukim in the Torah about waging war. Jews didn't have an army for almost 2,000 years, so the real situations that would cause the halakha to develop would not come up until the 1940s, and since then they have. So I would expect that we would start to be developing, and it wouldn't necessarily be pushing the natural development. Now that we have an army, and we have to develop such policies.
So I think it's a really interesting question, which Shlomo will have more. You know, I find myself accidentally writing lots about military ethics, of which is my children made enormous fun of me when I appeared at a panel on military ethics for Torah in Motion last year with like the guy who runs the Canadian Army Center of Military Ethics and Rav Asa Kasher, who wrote the Israeli Code, and me, because I happen to have written four articles on military ethics, but even though I have no army experience at all. I think it's a fair question, but I think the extent to which you want military halakha to extend to foreign policy, right? The policy is about the cause, right? About not only about right justice in war, but the justice of war, all right? And on what basis you want to instill ethical impulses? So this is along the distinction of Shlomo mentions, right? Is war ben adam l'chaveiro, or is war choshen mishpat? Right? I think that's an issue that we still need to address. All right. Thank you very much for carrying the share.